Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm Bob DeMarco. On this edition of the show, I'm speaking with knife maker Alex Steingraber, who first joined us on episode number 146. Now, in a short time, Alex and his Steingraber performance knives have become known for their super thin grinds, exotic steels, and dialed-in heat treatments. His debut knife, the Shark, created a lot of buzz for its blend of really refined EDC properties in a small and easily carried fixed-blade package. Now, I missed out on a drop that Alex himself gave me a heads up on, like a dunce. But I finally lucked into a Crewwear Shark on the secondary market, and it quickly earned a spot among my favorite EDC fixed blades. And I love to carry fixed blades. But Steingraber Performance Knives is on the threshold of something big, something exciting. And we're going to get into that in just a moment. But first, be sure to like, comment, subscribe, hit the notification bell, and then download us wherever you listen to podcasts, because this whole thing can be found on audio. So if you can't watch the whole thing on YouTube, you can download us and listen on your way to work or whilst doing dishes. And then you can join us on Patreon, where you can help support the show if that interests you. And there are a number of different levels of support, and you get, you get exclusive content and other perks and a chance to win a knife every month. So check it out by going to theknifejunkie.com/Patreon. Again, that's theknifejunkie.com/Patreon.
Do you like the sound of the alphanumeric combinations M390, 204P, and 20CV, but bristle at 8CR13MOV and AUS-8? You are a knife junkie, probably worse.
Hey, Alex, welcome to the show. Good to see you again.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. Do I sense a little more gray in the beard since last we spoke? Sorry.
You know what? Knife making's taking a toll on me, so...
So, before we get into the reason I really invited you back on the show, something I've been observing, kind of watching develop on Instagram. I'm sure everyone knows what I'm talking about, but, that's what I really want to talk to you about. But just in case people didn't listen to the first show, just let me know how you got into knife making and how in such a quick time you were, able to, come up with a design like this and then be able to execute like this.
Yeah, so I started actually back in, I want to say, roughly 2017, 2018, fiddling around in the garage, and then it progressed because I was also getting into the knife community at that point. And then a buddy of mine on Reddit was like, hey, you should make a knife out of K390. And I was like, all right, I'll just do that. So... got some steel and formulated a design, and then made two knives called, they were actually called the Great White, like a Great White Shark. And then I was like, oh, it'd be cool if I had like, you know, a Mako Shark and a Great White Shark and all these other sharks. And then I made four more knives, two out of, I think, K390, and then two out of L-Max. And it was the L-Max ones were kind of like the Mako type thing, or like the smaller of the two. And then I basically, after those sold or whatever, I kind of like laid one template on top of the other and kind of like was just playing around with it, and took out one area of the Great White Shark and then left some features of the Mako, and then it just evolved into the Shark.
So you had the Great White, you had the Mako, you took the best from both and distilled it into the Shark. The Shark is, this is a knife that I talk about a lot since I've gotten it. When I first got it, of course, I talked about it all the time, but, it's a great chore knife, not to mention the fact that if you like to carry EDC, fixed blades, which I do, it's very good and discreet. And I carry this in a way I don't carry any other knife, which is horizontally right on the front next to my belt buckle. And it's short enough that it kind of blends in if you have a sweater or anything on. But it's a great, great cutter.
Yeah. So that was another thing, is I wanted to make it, at least that design really thin, because the other ones were basically, when I sent things out for heat treat, I sent things to Peters, and they specifically say on their website, you know, 20,000s, keep it at that. And I was like, okay. But then also being in the knife community, you know, looking at other, what other people were experimenting with and reading other books and stuff like that, I was like, yeah, but I want to go way thinner. So it just, I realized that I had to like learn how to heat treat. I had to learn how to grind thinner in a safe manner, meaning not ruining the heat treat. And that's the direction I wanted to go in with all of this. And yeah, I mean, it's ever evolving. It's never not finished for me with any design. I just want to keep making it better. So yeah, I mean, Shark 2.0 for sure at some point, but yeah, that's kind of the gist of how I got into all of this without getting into super detail. But yeah, I really like the design of the Shark. I like that it's small enough. You can actually carry it in your front pocket as well, given different carry options and stuff like that. But yeah, I've had nothing but, you know, happy users for sure.
Well, one thing you can do with this knife in particular, when it's in the front pocket, is snag the thumb flare on the front of your jean, you know, on the pocket, and then just pull out and just have the blade.
So like an Emerson wave kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. It's like a fixed bladed wave. So something that impressed me about you from the beginning was that you were using these exotic steels, these super steels. And to me, I just sort of assumed that someone new or a relatively new would stick to the, I don't know, the less difficult to grind steels, but you kind of jumped right in.
Yeah, I have a habit of doing that. we're going to talk about that in a minute too, but yeah, I have a habit of just diving right into the most difficult thing I can think of and just either nailing it the first time or learning as I go. And that's definitely what I've learned from all these different steels, is they don't act the same. They certainly don't grind the same. I mean, anywhere is from, you know, 4V to Rex 121, I've heat treated it and ground it. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of reward with learning that way, learning by failures, I guess. Not so much, but I mean, yeah, learning by failure, trial by error, I guess.
Sure.
So,
and trial by fire or whatever. But from what I can discern from watching you on Instagram is that you're very methodical. I mean, it takes a while to figure out how each steel gets heat treated on its own, you know, optimally for that specific steel. And I feel like you cataloged the process of figuring all that out. And once you have figured that out, it's under your skin, right?
Yeah. And that's another thing too, is people don't, well, I may have shown it in the past, but when you get a new steel or a new melt, you want to test it. Meaning you want to heat treat a little coupon and you want to test it to see where things fall, how it acts, I guess. Mm-hmm. And there's not, I mean, now there is, you know, quite a bit of data out there, but there's still not that much data, if that makes sense. Like, there's data, but there's not a ton of data. And then most of the data you get are from, you know, guys that have taken that risk on blade forums and stuff and have their own little anecdotal things. And, you know, reading about Phil Wilson and how he just, like, you know, a man of his time basically is like using all of these steels and working with the steel companies. And, you know, then you got guys like Triple B that are just like taking it to a whole nother level and super nerding out on all the stuff, and it's great. And I would love to do all of that, but I also want to, you know, run my business and stuff like that. So learning, you know, some of these little tips and tricks from these guys, but then also doing things in a manner where I can, you know, keep things repeatable, I guess, is the way to go.
Well, you just basically answered something I was going to ask you, maybe. And that is, how has being someone who's business conscious, at least, right? You're kind of an entrepreneurial, you've got kind of an entrepreneurial spirit to you, from what I know of you. And how has that and your knowledge of how to run a business and your focus on running a business, how has that affected your knife making and your designing?
I mean, I started making knives before I became like businessy, but getting more into the business, it's definitely affected the way I approach things and the way, I mean, like for instance, the thing we're going to talk about in a second, definitely that, like a lot of these companies that have started out or not started out, have been around for a while, like, you know, Chris Reeve and Medford and Emerson, these guys all started exactly where I did. So you kind of either have to call them on the phone and ask them, or you have to just figure it out. And I'm have a mortal fear of just cold calling people and asking them for all this information and getting rejected. So I'm like, I'll just figure it out until I actually need a ton of help. But it's definitely shaped the way that I am going to, or I have and I'm going to approach all of this stuff in the future.
It seems kind of evident in your iteration and reiteration of the Shark and the Sasquatch, your second big model, and in your kind of like Chris Reeve and kind of like the other companies you mentioned, but especially Chris Reeve, you know, with a limited catalog of designs, you have the opportunity of really, really perfecting and dialing it in. And I'm not sure what run my particular Shark comes from. It's a crew wear. I think you determined it was maybe the second run from the look of the handle. But, you know, it was very, very quickly dialed in. And each time you make it, I imagine it gets more and more, you know, perfected. And that's a way that you can more quickly make more of them and sell more of them.
Right, right. Yeah, that was one thing that I wanted to take away from other companies is like constant quality control is like, if there's any issues in this batch, go to the second one and fix all of those and then release them and then see what feedback I get from customers or whomever. And then the next batch, fix that. The only thing I don't like about that is that, you know, I didn't get to fix it before they spent their money on it. Mm-hmm. And, but again, you know, the secondary market is nice to a lot of, you know, different knife models and stuff like that. And yeah, people can kind of get the return on investment and stuff like that. So it doesn't really bum me out as much, but still I'd like it to be as perfect as possible. And then when something comes back, just be like something like super simple, like, you know, just change the shape a little bit on the next one. Be like, okay.
Right, right, right. So it's a constant slight tweaking. Okay, so tell us what you're working on right now. You got something big in the works.
So yeah, right now I am working on a folding knife. It is called the Lamia. It is Greek for Lamia. I mean, it's a Greek demon if you're into Greek mythology. Basically the story behind her is she was having an affair with Zeus, got kicked out of the lightning mountain or whatever it's called.
Olympus.
And Olympus, yes. and was cursed by Zeus's wife, and basically Zeus's wife killed all of her children, Lamia's children, and then cursed her. And so Lamia went around just, you know, devouring children and have constant nightmares. So to remedy this, Zeus gave her the ability to take her eyes out. So it's like really dark and
love those Greeks.
Really crazy for the first knife model, but I wanted it to be sort of a transformation in words of what the Shark was to what it is evolving into now. And a lot of the features from the Shark have been brought over to the Lamia. A lot of the the agronomics of the Shark have been brought over to that, and the thinness of the blade has been brought over. And I think it's going to be, you know, I mean, I think, and I don't know at the same time, but I think it'll be great once I dial things in to where I'm comfortable releasing things out to the wild. But it's definitely taken a long time, over 2 years of designing and, you know, countless hours, as everyone has seen on Instagram, of just, you know, obtaining a machine and learning as I go CNC and figuring out, you know, fit tolerances and all this other stuff, and just things that they don't tell you on blade forums, and things that you need to figure out on your own, and things that you need to ask machinists, like actual machinists, about. Cause there's the knife maker way of machining, and then there's the actual machinist way of machining. And I don't know either. So I was like, I'm just going to figure out a new way. And that's what I did for this. So, but yeah, that's what I'm working on right now. And I can show you.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, there are so many questions, but I mean, how did you even, did you have any help, or how did you go from fixed blade, mind frame in terms of creativity in the shop, or in terms of just engineering in the shop, to that very complex everything of a folder?
So it was weird because, like, growing up, I didn't, like, my grandfather was a machinist for all my life, and I didn't really learn anything from him because I was so little. And I had, like, there's this one dude in the knife community that I chat with, and I was like, hey man, like, can you throw my Shark design into CAD? Or, I mean, CAM. No, not CAM, CAD, sorry. And he's like, yeah. So then I, you know, compensated him with a knife and, you know, took care of all that. And I was like, I got to learn how to do this, because I just can't keep, like, I don't want to bug people, and I just want to learn how to do it. So I learned how to do it with, like, the Shark handles. So at that point, when things were progressing, I was like, I have to make scales while I'm making knives, or this is not going to be sustainable. So I got a table router, learned how to program it, learned how to program CAM and YouTube, basically. And then at one point, I, like, wanted to know prices of machines, because I only knew pricing from what I saw on the internet, like eBay and stuff. And I was like, I wonder what, like, I don't want to deal with a used machine. I wonder what a brand new one is. Can't be that much. And then I got price quotes, and I was like, good Lord, that is more than some houses cost. So then I was like, all right, sign me up. Like, let's figure this out. Let's see how we can get a new one. So I was established enough where I talked to banks, and they're like, yeah, we'll take care of it. Don't worry. And, you know, I was not blessed with, you know, a bunch of money. So I had to go to the bank. They're like, yep, here you go. Is your business real? And I was like, yes, it's real. Come check it out. So they checked it out. They're like, yep, all right, you're good. Here's a bunch of money. Go do whatever you got to do. We'll take out the money every month to pay for it. I was like, all right, cool. So at that point, I was in another transition. The housing market here was, like, hot. So I was like, oh, I could sell my house and then move into a shop and then just figure out the rest. And so down the road, like a mile down the road, there was this, like, building, and I'd drive by it almost every day. And I was like, oh, that'd be cool to, like, own a shop like that. And fast forward, I contacted a guy that owned that building, or owns that building, and I spoke with him. And he was also in the manufacturing industry, or is in the manufacturing industry. Super awesome guy. And he rented me a space. And then I was like, by the way, I have a machine coming. Like, it's ready to be delivered here. And he's like, all right, let's figure it out. So, like, we knocked down part of a wall in the building. And, like, he was super, like, he's like, yeah, let's just get this going, man. Let's do it. He's like, I can tell you're going to do big things. Let's go. So we knocked down a wall and, like, got the machine in. And then from then on, I was, like, just in learning mode, like, learning as I go, watching YouTube, talking to friends, meeting new people online about how to do all this stuff. And here we are.
So what, how do you feel? You know, you go from years since 2017, just hand making knives from scratch, and then learning heat treating and, you know, gradually other, you're accumulating skills, but now you take this quantum leap, not only in the design of a folder, but also, the machine, the new shop, CAD CAM and all this. If you compare the, let's call it the handmade days versus these new, broader spectrum days, what are your feelings about the comparison there?
So I've thought about this a lot, and I've talked to a lot of friends in the machining industry about it, people that also work on knives. And, you know, back in the day when I was like, you know, hand grinding all this stuff, and I was like, man, this is such a pain in the ass, but got to get it done. And I would get things done fairly quickly. But now it's like you go from this thing that's pretty rudimentary to just a whole new thing that people actually go to college for. And try to learn all this stuff, and you have YouTube basically. I would say that machining knives, and I'm talking folders, not fixed blades, because fixed blades, I could probably bang out a fixed blade pretty quickly versus a machine. I would say folders are 1,000 times harder to do on CNC than if you had just a bridge port and, you know, a really nice drill press and all that stuff. Only because, well, from my experience is like, I'm not a machinist, and I know machinists that are doing this, and they even have trouble doing it. And there's a lot of fixturing involved. There's a lot of making sure things are located properly. There's a lot of, you know, you're cutting different materials, you're designing things in CAM and, or I mean CAD, and then you're programming it in CAM. And then if, you know, this one thing doesn't go around this corner the way you want it to, you have to draw another line and basically tell the program, no, I want to go this way, sort of thing. So it's a lot of, I don't know. I've thought long and hard about this, and no disrespect to people that make knives, you know, the old school way. This is a lot harder. Probably not physically, but definitely on your psyche and mentally, it's a lot.
Is that because it's not intuitive to you? Like, maybe it's more mathematical than it is physics and sculpting.
Actually, it's a ton of basic math, but the thing is that you're trying to figure out like your feeds and speeds. You'll hear that a lot, feeds and speeds. And the companies that create the end mills will give you a baseline, and that's all that is a baseline to get you started to where your end mill will not break. Now, if you want to go faster, that's up to you to figure out. So it's kind of like heat treating in a way where you're testing the waters. And because I've never worked in a machine shop, I don't know what a machine is supposed to feel or sound like when it's cutting certain materials. So I've been fortunate enough to get in touch with a tooling rep, and the guy that works there has worked in a machine shop all his life and went to school for material sciences. So he's like kind of coming over and helping with some feeds and speeds sometimes. And he's like, yeah, you're fine. He's like, you can go way faster than this. Like, you can do this. Like, so it's nice in that regard. But for me, just like being alone and being like, well, I guess that's okay. Nothing's breaking. The machine isn't like, you know, the spindle isn't overpowered. So I guess we're good. But then he comes in and he's like, you can go way faster. You'll be fine.
Okay. So maybe this 1,000 times more difficult on the psyche thing is because it's maybe still a little raw and new to you, and you have this machine that costs as much as your house. Okay.
Yes.
All right. But seemingly it will speed up your process, obviously, or you wouldn't be doing it because it's repeatable.
Well, yeah, definitely. Because, and that's the thing is like once I personally get comfortable, or if I ever hire on somebody that is in that profession is comfortable, then it won't be so daunting as far as, you know, trying to figure things out. It's just like, oh yeah, we did this on the other model. Let's just do it on this one and just change some things here. And I imagine it's the same thing everyone else went through that owns a knife company is like, they all started out with like, you know, basic things or like an old Bridgeport, and then they moved into CNC. So they also had learning curves. Cause I know I listened to an interview with Rick Hinderer. Like, he's like, I didn't know anything about that. So I had to figure it out. And now he has like, you know, 10 machines and it's just cranking out knives, and he barely even like has to deal with any of that stuff anymore. So it is possible, and it's definitely something that I enjoy as far as like the knives are a great thing that I enjoy to create and make and use. But then machining is like a whole nother level of like, you can nerd out on all that stuff. And I do that on a daily basis too, because it's like you're creating this art with a robot that cannot see and has no idea where it's at. And then you have to tell it what to do. You have to guide it to cut this material that it has no idea what it is. And it's just like a crazy, like, sentient being that you're controlling. And if you control it correctly, it works out well.
Well, you got to start talking nice to this thing and giving it the good oil, man. You want some good. So I noticed you had something in your hand, Alex. And for those of you who are not watching but are listening, other hand. Oh, okay, so let's take a look at this.
So this is the Lamia, and you'll notice some features of it that come from the Shark. So most of the scale design came from the Shark. This kind of little back end came from the Shark, and kind of this swoopy down area. The blade height is thinner. I believe the blade length is 3.6 inches. And then the handle is longer, so you can get that full grip. And then you have that kind of little nub back there. This way it's a little awkward, but we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. It runs on phosphor bronze phosphor bearings, TV washers. Not bearings, washers. Sorry. The hardware, we have T15 and T10, and then a milled pocket clip and a milled backspacer. Pretty, you know, basic. But all of the texturing here is not, it's not a chamfer. Like, you'll see a lot of like just a flat slab of titanium and then hard chamfer, like a 50 thou chamfer. This is all contoured out with a ball end mill. Because there's like a weird radius that I wanted to get that I couldn't get it with a chamfer. So I was like, oh, I got to use the ball end mill.
So basically the surface of a chamfer is flat, but the surface of what you have there is radiused.
Like ever so radius. Like, it's a very subtle radius. I didn't want a hard chamfer because I wanted it to be able to, like, I know when you tumble it, it'll wear down, but like, I just wanted it to be a certain way. And the way I designed it, I just wanted it to be that way. And I left the milling in there. So there's like a step down, but it's all even all the way around on both sides. So it gives it a little micro milling texture, I guess. And then this little cutout here. And then the cutout for the lock bar. And then the lock bar is very thin. So there is some flexure to it. And that's something I've been, you know, dealing with, and also have been finding out that it's like it flexes up a little bit. Just because this cutout right here is 1/16 of an inch. So if I made that thinner, it wouldn't flex as much. And there's other tricks and stuff that knife makers use to stop flexure. It happens on, you know, CRKTs and stuff like that. So I don't find it a flaw, and I don't find it a feature, but I want to get rid of it at some point. So that's something I'll definitely be working on. Anode. So that's another thing I had to learn how to anodize. I have no idea how to do that.
And no hardware on that clip. I got to say, this is really a beautiful knife. I'm so glad it's 3.6 inches. It's like the perfect size. and it's got that perfect handle shape of the shark. The blade is beautiful, elongated. I think the overall profile of the whole thing when it's open, it already looks like a classic, but it doesn't look like anything else except the shark a little bit. It's a little evocative of the shark, but that's about it. I think this is very exciting. How many of these have you made so far?
So this one right here, I guess you would consider it the working prototype. I've been just fitting everything into this and just seeing what I need to change in the past few weeks. As far as, you know, quantity, I have 15 of them that I've machined out. I just need to machine the blades and the backspacers and clips. I've sent material out to get double disc ground and waiting on that to come back.
What's
to
double work disc on ground? That stuff.
So double disc grinding is a process where you will thin down material, but instead of a traditional like giant Blanchard grinder, which is a giant grinder with a big head that spins and it just hogs material off, this is, you flip it and it grinds this way and it takes material off of both sides. But you can get fairly precise, and not as precise as some people think, but you know, within 3/1000ths of an inch to 1/1000th of an inch, depending on the size of the material, from what I'm told. I use a company that's local to me that apparently almost most knife companies use, which is the company's called Nifty Bar, if anyone wants to look it up. But I know Grimsmo used to use them and a bunch of other companies used to use them. The only thing is it doesn't have to be super like, at least not yet. It doesn't have to be super like within a few tenths or whatever of thickness and all that other stuff. It's like they hit a thou, like give or take across the part or across the piece that I sent them. And I was fine with that. I also told them to go tighter than that. And they're like, well, that's all we can hit is a thou. And I was like, all right. And got it back. And so anyway, I'm waiting for that material to come back to machine the rest of the components for.
Presumably you would take it the rest of the way, right? If you wanted it thinner, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. So as far as this, like this blade was all machined on the machine. This bevel was done on the machine.
So what blade steel are you going to be using on these? And are you going to have different, I mean, I know this is still at the early stage, but what are your plans for the steel? And then in general, like, what are your plans for how you want this project to evolve over time?
I've been thinking a lot about that. As far as the steel, it's not going to change as far as what steels I use. I'm going to go, I guess, all shark on it, but it's not going to be in the same regard as like I'm doing this steel drop. Okay. It's just I'm going to buy a bunch of steel and then just start making, you know, throwing blades in these knives. And then as they go up, if you want that one, you gotta get it. Down the road, I definitely want to separate it by steel category, but it's right now, it's just like with the scarcity of a lot of steels that people want. And, you know, just me also learning as I go, it's just not feasible to just, you know, do a giant drop of like just one steel. I just need to grab a bunch of different steels and just push it through. And then also I'm testing it at the same time to see how it responds to heat treat. Because like I said, I'm machining all of these off the machine and then I'm heat treating them after, which give or take, you know, whatever way you want to do it. But the rule of thumb is 20/1000ths of an inch, but now I recently read on Peter's heat treating website that it's 15 thou. So
is that so it doesn't work? Are you saying,
yeah.
So okay, so you can grind down the blade to about 20/1000ths or 15/1000ths thick,
yep,
before and then safely heat treat it before you can expect that blade to warp on you?
Correct.
So then that's when you would take it the rest of the way with your grinder,
right? But I have one that I tested out in 4V that I machined it 12/1000ths and heat treated it and I got zero warping. So
Oh, nice.
I'm going to see how far down I can go. This probably isn't going to be as thin as the shark, but it's definitely going to be thin as, I guess, big name production knives like Benchmade and Spyderco and stuff like that. But I do want to do some hand ground versions to get super thin and offer those as well. So I'm not, you know, I'm not a stranger to the grinding wheel. So it's definitely something I want to do. But I also want to get the machine dialed in to where these are consistent. And as far as, you know, quote unquote surface finishes, I think I'm going to take a risk and leave the milling on the blade and just kind of blast it in with the blade. Because if you look at like a Benchmade or any big name production knife, they have grind lines on them that are basically a CNC grinder ground those lines and they go vertically. So these are just horizontally. I don't know if you can see it, but you definitely cannot feel it at all. You can only see it. So I don't think it's something that, I think it's something that adds to the essence of this came from a machine. I want people to know that it came from a machine. And then if I grind one, I want people to know that I ground it, sort of thing.
I got you, but it's not just, for symbolizing how it was made. It's also got to be an aesthetic choice, I would imagine, because though I can't see on the camera here, I've seen other blades that have various mill lines, and it can be very, very much a part of the look and very attractive, you know?
Right, yeah. Like take, for instance, like the Norseman that has the step marks in it. So these would have the same step marks. My step over is about 0.3 inch. So every 0.3 inch, it steps over and it's super smooth. But as far as visual right off the machine, it may not be appealing to some. It may be appealing to some, but you know, we have blasting medias and tumblers and stuff like that. So you kind of blend everything so it looks nice.
So when you were designing this knife and coming up with what you wanted it to be, what were your design priorities and how did you, I mean, I know you wanted to basically translate the shark, but in terms of a folder, what do you appreciate in a folder and what did you want this to be?
I know I wanted like the opening to be some sort of hole or opening just because it's just something that I've clicked with as far as the way I open knives. I've never been a fan of thumb studs. And that's just a personal preference. I'd rather have a hole versus a thumb stud. And I think that's the only major thing other than I was going to do this all in aluminum, but then I realized, and after research, that aluminum probably wouldn't be the greatest idea for two scales. If it were an integral, probably, like if it were just one piece. But this is the main thing, is just having some sort of hole. Now, this hole can evolve over time for sure. But as far as everything else, I had no idea how to... This is my first knife design. I've taken apart a lot of knives. And I guess that I didn't really pay attention as much as some people do or don't when you take apart a knife. Because you're like, it's just like this angle and then this thing sits on here and blah, blah, blah. But if you actually like break it down and like look, each knife has its own unique like tang angle. And like there's a positive or negative rake on the lock face. And even the lock face could be, you know, turned different angles and stuff like that. So it's like all these things that you learn as you go or... Because like there's a lot of people who are like, oh yeah, just throw on a 7.5 degree on the tang and you should be fine. And I'm like, okay. And then you do it and it fails and you're like, oh, well, that didn't work. So now what? And they're like, I don't know. That's what everyone else says. And it's just like, okay.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem like that should translate directly from one person's design to another.
And, you know, I didn't even think about it until I was getting into the whole lock thing. And then, you know, reading excerpts from Bob Truzula's book is like, yeah, 7.5 to 8.5, you're fine. And then, you know, and then looking at other guys that have made knives are like, no, it's actually 6 degrees to you know, 9 degrees. And it's just like, it could be anywhere in there. And they're like, my preference is this. So you got to figure it out. And I'm like, great. So yeah. And then also on top of it, because the blade stock is 100,000ths of an inch thick, there is like, there is no area to really lock up on. So you're getting 40 to 50% lockup, and it has to fit somewhere in there. So I had to basically figure out what rake angle to use for the 7.5 degrees. And I mean, it may change in the future. I may drop it down to 6 just to get a little bit more bite in there, but, yeah, there's solid lockup, doesn't fail. Did, you know, a couple spine whack tests and stuff like that. And I've come up with a new method of that because I think that's kind of archaic, but, I'm coming up with a new method to test out the strength of a lock bar. I just need to, purchase one little item and I should be able to test it, because it's like, how much weight does it actually hold? How much weight should it hold? You know, right. I want a middle ground. I don't want it to just like, what if it fails at 100 pounds versus it doesn't fail at 50 pounds versus, you know, I want a number.
Yeah. And then kind of, go for that number each time or make it. So would you say that the lockup and that interface between the lock bar, and I could see, it looks like you had a steel lock bar insert in there. Yeah,
let me take it apart. I wanted to take it apart, so I'm going to take it apart really quick.
Would you say that the coming up with the lock geometry and all of that, was that the most difficult part of this whole process of learning how to make a folder? Or what was the hardest part?
I think the hardest part was like, and it may be weird, it's like making fixtures for all of this stuff. Because you got to like, you have to hold down all the metal somewhere in the machine where it doesn't move, and it's, you know, strong enough to be machined at those, under those conditions. So I think that was the hardest part of all of this, was designing that, but also
the fixtures.
But also, yeah, like, and I don't want to come off as like an a-hole, but there's a lot of people out there that will tell you how to do it, and they have never, you know, made a knife or machined anything. And I definitely take that advice. Like, you probably know more than I do about taking apart knives and stuff like that. So I'm going to take that, but also I'm going to research it and like look up to see what the best option is. And that's what I did. But as far as actual design of the knife, yes, it's definitely the lock interface. So yeah, we have inside pockets, you know, probably made in the USA as engraved on the inside of this pocket.
Nice. So we're looking at one scale. We're looking at the show scale.
Yeah, this is the show scale.
Alex has taken apart the Lumia, and the show scale titanium is nicely milled out, very heavily pocketed. And in one of the pockets, it says probably made in the USA.
And then this is what the lock scale looks like on the inside. So I had different pockets on the top, but the machining just took way too long. So I was like, let me just use circles. So, and it afforded me the opportunity to put the serial number or the make number inside this little pocket right here. I don't even know if you can see that.
So yeah, I can see that.
All right, that's number 5, and this has been like the guinea pig right here. So everything is super simple. So it like indicates on these pins, and one acts as the lock bar or the lock stop or the blade stop. And then the other one just indicates this, and you pull this off, and then you have your backspacer. And both of these are screwed from either side, so the show scale and the lock scale. So you would unscrew this, and then this just comes right off. Pretty simple. And then, like I said, it just slides right onto there. So that's just the piece that holds everything in there. And then, so you got that. And then this guy right here is the lock insert. I may redesign this in the future, but it's pretty big. Like, it's pretty big piece of metal. Like, I need to make this look a little bit better, but this just unscrews from the other side. And the good thing about this is that the detent isn't pressed into the steel, it's pressed into the titanium, but also the lock bar insert is kind of indicated. It's kind of indicated these studs right here. So this is where the detent ball is. And then there's this other stud over here. So then this guy just slips right in. And
the detent ball is sitting at the top of that one locating post.
Yep.
That's cool. That's a great way. That seems like a great way of doing it. What's the benefit of embedding that in the titanium and not in the steel itself?
It's going to hold a little bit better. I have had detent balls fly out, though, if you don't push them in far enough. But the hold is there, and I think I may, depending, it'll be easier to replace, too, if I need to replace it. But you could put it in the steel, but, I mean, I've read things that it could fall out, and if you don't have the steel at a certain hardness, it won't mushroom in there or form in there. Whereas titanium, you just press it right in there.
Yeah, I was going to say the softness of the titanium kind of accepts it. So something I'm really excited about the Lumia is, first of all, we're a bunch of Greek mythology nerds in my family, especially my girls. They know, I'm sure they know about Lumia. I did not. But so I like the name, of course, but I like that. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm equal opportunity. I love flippers. I love bearings. Don't get me wrong, but I love phosphor bronze washers and a slow roll action even better. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that this knife in particular is exciting to me. It's just really dialed in on that level. It seems dialed in. I mean, I'm assuming because it's yours, it's dialed in, but it's not going for the falling shut on your finger necessarily. It looks like a smooth hydraulic kind of Sabenza like action and build.
And that's the funny thing about all of this is like, and I may get crucified for it, but the only expensive knife that I've owned, well, other than recently, is a Strider. And I know there's a lot of dividedness on, you know, Strider and quality and action and all that other stuff. For what that knife is, I think it's a really well-built knife. But then there's people that have, you know, like CRKT, and I've held a ton of hinderers, so I know how that action is. But like, I've never held a CRKT, so I have no idea when people talk about, you know, hydraulic folding action on washers. And I'm just like, well, let's figure it out and let's see if it's even close. So I don't really know. And even the tier of like, you know, what price range all these knives fall in and what quality people are expecting. So I know people talk a lot about tolerances and stuff like this, and that's fine. but I don't know the tolerance of like a CRKT by like looking at it. I know that they're probably pretty tight because
you mean Chris Reed knives CRK? Chris
or, Reed yeah, I'm oh. sorry, CRK. I know that they're probably really tight because A, I watched videos on how he made them, and he's talked about it. And I know that Tim has also talked about it as well. As far as Hinderer, I know that, you know, things are very tight on their end because they have, you know, computerized measuring machines and CMMs and stuff like that. So all that aside, I don't know what people are expecting. So I just need to design this and make this with the best knowledge that I have in comparing all of these. Now, I recently was privy to obtaining a Shirogorov F95, and holy cow, if that's what we need to hit, then damn it, let's do it. But man, that knife is amazing. But yeah, my buddies have sent me other knives by other makers, and I get it. I get why things are at a certain price point, and I get why things are the way they are. So I just want to be on the same playing field, but I also want to offer, you know, my uniqueness to all this as well.
And would you say that your uniqueness is your grinding, your heat treating, your design, and your steel choice?
I would say that.
I guess that's for everybody, but you are known for your heat treat and your grinding.
Which is weird because there's so many other guys that are way better at heat treating than, I'm not saying that I'm crappy at heat treating, but there are so many guys out there that take it to the next level and really like, they really take the time and dial things in step by step by step, like to the nth degree. Like they know, you know, this needs to be at, you know, 2000, you know, 155 degrees, and they get that repeatability that they like. But I'm, you know, I'm aiming for just a 1 point range, and that's way better than what we're getting from, you know, other places. But yeah, I would think that that's something I definitely bring to the table. And then like the also like somebody, it was funny, somebody mentioned like, well, you're clearly directly competing with Dan Osborne and his Roosevelt knife. So, and I'm like, but I'm not though. Like, I don't even know the guy. I've never talked to the guy in my life. And secondly, I don't care what other people are doing because the bottom line is knives are all going to look the same at some point. You know, people design based off of, you know, their tastes or their, you know, what they see. And, like when you had, names blanking. Ken Onion on, he was talking about designing from animals. He would just pull animals and that's how he designed. I design similarly, but I also will take little aspects of, you know, things that inspire me, like having the hole or, you know, having a lock bar insert or things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I want to bring all these uniquenesses to the table and I just do what people are doing, but do it differently, I guess. So there's some knives that are just fully anode. Like this one right here is not going to, it's going to be, this is going to be your color, you know?
Yeah.
Not your color choice, but just having that little splash of color and that's it. That sort of thing. So
I love it. And it also creates a canvas. I know that's kind of a cliche, but, I just got something back from the Knife Modders. It's a very simple titanium knife and I got it back and it's beautifully, you know, so if you care to do something like that, that sort of blank canvas is a, you know, it's a good opportunity to make it your own.
And it's funny you bring that up because that's actually what I thought about doing with all of these is like, I know a lot of people want a customized knife and I don't want to offer that. Like, I don't want to be like crass about it. It's just like, it's not something I'm interested in doing. But there are a ton of modders out there that I know that are my friends too. So like the knife modders, like I talk to those guys almost every day. And to give them something like this, just there you go. This is what you get to mod. And it's just like, yes, like finally, I don't have to like take off orange peel or I don't have to do this and I don't have to do that. And it's just like you said, a blank canvas. And then now the customer is the artist. Because then they can relate it back to the knife modder and then they can, you know, make their dream as far as colors and textures a reality.
I just got this back from them, the knife modders. This is, this was the one. It was a plain silver and they just did beautiful work. So, I mean, I love that option. I would rather have that option, than, you know, a whole bunch of gaudy. Then again, you know, maybe you don't know a knife modder, maybe you don't want to go that far. So that having that splash a color is nice in the backspacer and on the clip. Right. So let me ask you this. So now you've turned this corner and you're working on this and you're in the R&D process, but you're pretty damn far into it. So once this is dialed in and you start producing it and you start, you know, making them and selling them, like where do you want to see this go and how do you want to see this new process affect your company?
I've been thinking a lot about it and I'm still thinking about where I want to go, but I still want the whole QCI aspect. I still want to make things better and I still want feedback from people, but I want to keep it like pretty simple. Like this, the term that I learned when I was in college and in TV and marketing was the KISS system. Keep it simple, stupid. I want to keep things simple as far as that and then kind of translate the same techniques that I did on this one and translate it into the next one. and so on and so forth. And I already have in my brain a flipper tab knife on bearings that I want to work on as well. So instead of just having this and then making a smaller version or a bigger version, a whole new design, just going right into a new design. Like, this is going to be what it is as far as size. And then the next one will be what it is as far as size. Like, there's not going to be a mini, there's not going to be, you know, an XL. And I want to try my hand at tactical knife at some point, only because it's something that, to me, it depends on what the design is as far as a tactical knife. Some appeal to me and some don't. And I want to understand, I guess, because that's like more of it's a tactical tool. And I want to understand the design process behind a tactical folder versus something that is just not so much show, but like is just designed to just cut. Whereas a tactical folder does, in my brain, you know, many different things. Like, I don't know. I think that those parallels are definitely different. And I think a tactical folder has more uses for some versus other, you know, showy, flashy knives, you know?
Yeah, it's like a tactical knife has more requirements, you know?
Right.
It definitely has to have a good traction plan. It has to have, you know, whatever it is, realistic grip. It has to have a sharp blade, you know?
Right.
Whatever those things are. But they're a little bit more critical because of the use, whereas right. It seems like you could have more flexibility in designing just an EDC. I don't mean just an EDC, but something that's not intended to save your life in a, you know, combat situation.
And that's what I want to do, is because I had this one guy who's a firefighter. He contacted me about the Shark, and he was like, hey, would this be something that would, you know, I could take on the job and, like, you know, cut people out of cars with? And I was just like, maybe. And I'm like, let me just do a test for you. So I took a knife and I just dropped it on the ground as high, like, I think I was like standing on a chair or something like that in my garage. And like the very tip broke off. And I was like, if you think that this would still benefit you, then yes. But I was like, I don't feel comfortable saying yes. And mm-hmm. He's like, all right, I totally understand. Like, thank you for, you know, doing that small test and blah, blah, blah. So I want to offer something that, like, so one guy can have this knife for this. One guy can have, you know, like, kind of down the line, like, right. In every day, I guess, like, a design for every use. Because there's, like, steels that are designed for certain uses as well in right. certain hardnesses. So having a knife that also would cater to those that are looking for, you know, something a little bit beefier, something, you know, a little bit more elegant then.
Yeah, I mean, the firefighter example is the perfect example, because, you know, if he took the Shark into a, you know, fire situation, the Shark might do fine, but the Kydex might, you know, loosen up and
right.
and the knife might drop out. So yeah, for each use, a dedicated thought or a dedicated, you know, purpose in designing it. So I know everyone's going to want to know, and I definitely want to know also. And no pressure, but when can we expect to see the first Lumias kind of going up for testing and sale and that kind of thing?
The double disc grinding was quoted to be done by towards the end of the month. So as soon as that gets in, I'll run pocket clips and some backspacers. I'm going to try to get at least like 3 or 4 or maybe 5 ready. And then as far as the purchasing option, I think I may do like some sort of lottery to begin with, just because it would be kind of weird just to do a drop, because then it would take longer for me to kind of pump through all of these, and it would be like another, you know, few weeks. I don't want people to wait anymore. And then as far as pricing, it is up on one of my Instagram posts, but I had it at 600, and I think I'm going to maybe look at that number again. I have had some people contact me about that, and my thought process behind it was, because I'm going to offer a wide range of steel, I kind of want to encapsulate all of that and not have to raise the price every time I use a new steel. Mm-hmm. So the only steels that I would raise the price on would be something like higher in vanadium. So like a 15V or maybe 10V, probably not even 10V, probably 15V in like a Rex 121, because I do want to offer these in those high, you know, crazy steels as well. So I'm going to revisit that, and I'm going to look at other people, you know, doing these, making them the way I am, and kind of revisit that and take a look at it. And I also want to offer a G10 show scale version. And obviously the price would reflect that. It would be a lower price. But yeah, I want to, you know, make it so the business grows, but also make it so people are happy and people get a fair, you know, fair price on all of this stuff. And considering that this is my first knife, it's just like, I don't know, like I'm not going to make it $100, but it's certainly not going to be, you know, $900 like a Grimsmo knife was. It's been $900 for like 10 years. So,
right. But remember, this is not your first knife. You've proven yourself a couple of times with these exquisitely ground. So in other words, people have faith in you already. And I think that, I'm sure a vast majority of people who are interested will accept whatever price you set. I mean, maybe not whatever price you set, but to me, that seems realistic.
And I've had it all over the place. Like some people have contacted me and been like, why is it so low? You need to raise your price. And I'm like, listen, like I'm not going to do that. And then other people are like, why is it so expensive? And I'm like, listen, it's a lot of work. And
you make one.
Right. And so it's been supportive in many aspects and questioned in others. So I want to revisit everything again. Like if I were hiring a lot of OEM internally in the United States to make all of this stuff, obviously the price would be, you know, considerably lower. But the fact that I'm doing everything from the ground up, it's not that I'm trying to just make bank on this. It's, you have to, you know, pay overhead and inflation is a thing. Like steel prices have gone up, titanium prices have gone up. I can't pretend that it didn't. So I'm going to wager a guess as well that across the market, everything is going to increase quite significantly as far as materials and as far as, you know, newer steels like Magnacut. I know Tim is running a bunch of Magnacut knives, and I would wager that it's going to go up pretty significant. So I want to be, as far as pricing, in the same realm as everyone else. Now, if I were just cranking out, you know, a bunch of these and, you know, sent everything through Taiwan, then yeah, it would definitely be lower. No question about it. But that's something that I've thought about it, and it's something that maybe years down the line, if I come up with a design and super popular and I want to make a lot of them, then that's something that would definitely happen. But I don't know. I kind of want to stick to the lower production, you know, higher quality that I can produce type thing. And I want people to get their money's worth. And, you know, having things like warranties and stuff like that are definitely going to be something that I'm going to stand by. So if anything happens, and that's another reason why I had, you know, this lock insert and I wanted it repeatable, is if this thing fails, I can just ship out another one and the customer can install it and be good to go.
Well, I really understand your being compelled to keep it to right now prestige pieces. And you might not agree with that term, but what I mean is that each knife you make is exclusive, and that increases the value of it. And I'm not talking monetary value necessarily. I'm just talking about the value of the knife itself because of the rarity. And I can see how you would want to keep your hands in this as much as possible moving into the future. And then as things can automate more, well, then you're in an even better place. Alex, thank you so much for coming on the Knife Junkie podcast. It's a great pleasure. And for those of you out there who are patrons, I'm going to be talking a little bit more with Alex on the other side. So join us there. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us on the podcast. And we'll talk to you soon, man.
Yeah.
Take care.
Do you like the sound of the alphanumeric combinations M390, 204P, and 20CV, but bristle at 8CR13MOV and AUS-A? You are a knife junkie. Probably worse.
I am very, very excited to see what these Lumias are like in hand. I mean, and to get such a close-up look at one assembled. I mean, I've been watching them on Instagram, and I've seen a lot of fixtures and a lot of parts, but this has got a real sense of what this knife is going to be like, and I'm really excited. I'm very excited for Alex, and you can just tell that this man is driven by this mission, and it's exciting to see it unfold through his methodical ways, so I can't wait to check that out. Check out other great knife makers here on the Knife Junkie podcast every Sunday. And Wednesday, you can check out the Midweek Supplemental, where I go through new knives in the industry and, of course, new knives in my glorious collection. And then Thursday Night Knives, our live feed, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on YouTube and Facebook and Twitch. Join us there. Until next time, I would like to thank Jim for working his magic behind the switcher, and also thank Alex for his time in joining us here. Until next time, please don't take dull for an answer.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, thenifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at thenifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on thenifejunkie.com/Instagram and join our Facebook group at thenifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@thenifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487, and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.